So 2 weeks ago, we studied in the first portion of Mark chapter 7 about Jesus' teaching on what defiles a person. And this occurred in the city of Gennesaret, as we've been kind of going through this whole story in the Gospel of Mark and kind of following Jesus' travels. And so a couple weeks ago, Jesus was in the city of Gennesaret, which is kind of over here on the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee. Not sure if you can read that up there on the map, but in any case, our text today, Jesus has left there and gone to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And interestingly, that is not in Israel. It actually is all up here. Here's Tyre, as you can see on the map there. And that is not in the territory of Israel. This is a heavily Gentile, Canaanite region. And presumably, Jesus retreats here in order to try and find some sort of respite. But as verse 24 of this chapter notes, even here, he was not able to do this because it says there that he could not be hidden. He just couldn't get away. Everyone knew him. Everyone recognized him. His fame was spreading far and wide at this point, even outside the borders of Israel. And so, our text this morning is a very interesting section of an encounter between Jesus and a Gentile woman, because he's in a Gentile area. More specifically, she is called a Syrophoenician woman from this region of Tyre and Sidon. And she was your classic Canaanite, yet she knew about Jesus. This text makes it very clear that Jesus' fame had reached even this Hellenistic Gentile region. We read that this woman had a daughter, and this daughter was possessed by a demon. And of course, it's not the first time that we have had a demon possession and Jesus casting out a demon in this story, in Mark's Gospel. And she comes to Jesus, she hears that he's there, and she comes and she falls down before him and she begs Jesus to cast this demon out of her daughter. So let's read this text beginning in verse 24. And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, but yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth. And she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." But she answered him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this statement you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. The initial response that we read here of Jesus is probably somewhat of a shocking one. You read that and it makes you sort of, you know, do a double take and think, wait, what? What did he just say? Why did he say that? I don't understand. And it maybe even came off a little bit rude. You really have to stop and dig in and think about the point that Jesus is trying to make here when he talks to this woman. That the text goes out of his way to note she is a Gentile. And there are several important points that I think we can take from this text today. And so that's what I want to help us do as we continue in our study of Mark this morning. And the first point that I want us to take from this is that Jesus was willing to add a blessing even unto the Gentiles. Now, just first I want to note a couple things here about this region of Tyre and Sidon. Again, it's to the northwest of Israel. It was a very mighty, powerful city in the Old Testament. Its main power was economic and trade. It was prophesied against in our recent studies in the book of Ezekiel. It was a fortified city that was very difficult to conquer because of the fact that it was actually on an island off of the Mediterranean coast. Nebuchadnezzar himself laid siege to the city of Tyre in an effort to conquer it for actually 13 years. He laid siege to the city but was unable to conquer it during that time. Now, he did severely weaken it. It was never really the same after that, but he never was able to actually conquer the city. And it wasn't until Alexander the Great came along in around 332 and tore down all the cities on the coast and used all that stuff to make a land bridge out to this island And then he laid siege to it for, I think, another 6 or 7 months before he finally conquered it. This was a very well-fortified city, a very well-protected city, and a very prominent city. And in fact, it was prominent even going back to the days of Solomon. They donated many things for the building of the temple to Solomon. And so, certainly a well-known city. But again, this is a Hellenistic Gentile region where Jesus is known, and his fame is spreading. And going back to chapter 5, Jesus had already performed miracles in this Gentile, Gentile regions. You actually go back to chapter 5, as I said, was going to come back to this. That a separate Gentile region is where Jesus cast out the legion of demons in Mark chapter 5. And so going back to the map, think about it in your head. I'm not going to go back. On the east side and southeast side of the Sea of Galilee is the region known as the Decapolis. And that was a Gentile region where Jesus had already worked miracles of healing there as well. And so this shouldn't be anything new, that Jesus was willing to go into Gentile areas and was willing to help Gentile people. This isn't even new to Jesus. If you go back to the Old Testament and the story of Elijah, Elijah also aided a Canaanite woman in the same area, the widow of Zarephath, in 1 Kings chapter 17, verses 8 through 24. And so the willingness of Jesus to aid a non-Jew, and a woman no less, should not shock us, though it would have been shocking to them at the time. A couple other examples of the very same thing where Jesus interacts with non-Jews. In John chapter 4, a very similar instance with the woman at the well. Jesus shockingly interacting with not just a woman, but a Gentile woman or a Samaritan woman in this instance. Not fully Gentile, but not fully Jew either. In John chapter 12, some Greeks come seeking Jesus and they are brought to him. He's willing to talk with them. Matthew chapter 8, where the centurion's servant is healed, is another example. Plenty of times where Jesus is willing to help non-Jews. And then finally, at the end of this story here in Mark, in verses 31 through 37, he returns from the region of Tyre and Sidon and goes back to the east side of Galilee to this region of the Decapolis. And we'll study this next week as well, where Jesus heals a deaf man there. And so plenty of instances of this type of activity. But this is something that shouldn't be a surprise to us, that God was going to bless the Gentiles also. This is something that's been prophesied about since the Old Testament, the time and time and time and again. Of course, the first one being, namely, in Genesis chapter 12. Though, really, you go back to Genesis chapter 3 in the prophecy to Eve. But, also Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3, the promise to Abraham that through him all the nations of the earth would be blessed. And, of course, lest someone say, well, that's not an accurate interpretation of that prophecy. Paul actually confirms that interpretation in Galatians chapter 3. In verse 8, when he says, and the scripture, foreseeing that God would justify the Gentiles by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abraham, saying, in you shall all the nations be blessed. And so he directly quotes from Genesis chapter 12 and verse 3 there. A few other examples would be in Isaiah as well as in the Psalms. We can go back and look at a couple of these. Isaiah chapter 42 and verses 5 through 9. Isaiah 42, verses 5 through 9. Isaiah writes, thus says God, the Lord who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth, and what comes from it. He gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk in it. I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will take you by the hand and keep you. I will give you as a covenant for the people, a light for the nations, to open the eyes that are blind, to bring out the prisoners from the dungeon, from the prison, those who sit in darkness. And then also over in Isaiah chapter 49, verses 5 through 6. Isaiah 49, 5 and 6. And now the Lord says, he informed me from the womb to be a servant, to bring Jacob back to him, and that Israel might be gathered to him. For I am honored in the eyes of the Lord, and my God has become my strength. He says, it is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light for the nations. The same phrase used there in both Isaiah 42 and 49, that he would be a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. Could it be any clearer than that? I don't think that it can. He's not just going to raise up Jacob and Israel, but he is going to raise up all the nations and bring his salvation to all of them. Several others as well. I'm not going to go through them all for sake of time this morning. There are many behind you on the screen. In the Psalms, Psalm 47 and 99 talk about how God is the God of all nations. Psalm 47, 1, 86, 9, 117 all talk about how all nations are going to worship Him. Israel praising God to the other nations in Psalm 9, 96, and 105. And then you get to the New Testament, and you get to the example of Simeon in Luke chapter 2. And I will go ahead and turn over there. In Luke chapter 2, as Simeon is prophesying there, and he actually quotes from the verses we just read in Isaiah 42 and 49, and he says, "Lord, now you are letting your servant depart in peace according to your word, for my eyes have seen your salvation." He's just seen Jesus, the baby. And it says there that you have prepared in the presence of all peoples a light for revelation to the Gentiles and for glory to your people, Israel. A light. That's what Jesus was. It's bringing light to all of them. And so this story here in Mark chapter 7, it's not just incidental. It's not just, well, that Jesus just happens to be in this area and, you know, this woman happens to come up to him and he happens to decide to heal her. No, everything is for a reason. Jesus goes here to make a very specific point, and that is that his blessing is going to reach even unto the Gentiles, even unto those that the Jews viewed as merely dogs. And so this foreshadows the future ministry of not only Jesus himself, but also of the apostles later on. Jesus himself confirms this later in Mark chapter 13, in verse 10. Mark chapter 13 and verse 10, he says, "And the gospel must first be proclaimed to all nations." This is what his apostles are going to be sent out to do. The gospel is going to be proclaimed in the whole world. Again, Mark chapter 14, in the next chapter, in verse 9, Jesus says, "Truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her." Peter, obviously, is another example of this in Acts chapter 10, where Peter is sent to Cornelius' household in Acts chapter 10, and they become the first Gentile converts. And then Paul, of course, says in Galatians 1:16 that he was the apostle unto the Gentiles. That was his job. And so the first point, and maybe the most important point that we should take from who Jesus is helping and where he is helping, is that he showed that he was bringing salvation not only to the Jews, but to the Gentiles as well. His physical healing foreshadowed the spiritual healing and inclusiveness that would arrive in the Messianic kingdom. The location and the recipient are indicative of that. And this much should have been clear. But now I want to get a little bit into the text itself. And first we need to look at the context. We, again, recognize that Jesus couldn't even hide from the people. His popularity is so high. We, again, want to note that most people would have been indignant that he was talking to a Gentile and talking to a woman, the same as in John 4 with the Samaritan woman. And you have to believe that the Pharisees got wind of this and were indignant about it. It only added to their desire to destroy him. But what happens here? This woman, she hears that Jesus has come. And like so many others in the gospel, what does she do? She immediately goes without hesitation, without fear, and goes and falls down at his feet and begs him to heal her little daughter who has a demon. And I like how the text notes here. It doesn't just say she had a daughter. It says she had a little daughter. Mark likes to make a lot of those, you know, little details that a lot of the other gospels don't. What parent among us wouldn't do the same thing, wouldn't do anything to help our child that was in some sort of dire situation? And the other thing we need to note about this is that there is, you know, in their time, a stigma attached to demon possession. If you had a demon, well, it must be because you're just an awful person. You know, it's because you're sinful. You know, and that's why this person or maybe her sin was passed down to her daughter or whatever. That would have been their understanding of this. Demon possession is because of sin. And they accuse Jesus even of having a demon in John 8:48 in order to try and discredit him and say that he was a sinner so they wouldn't have to listen to him. And Jesus says, no, it's not why. It's so that the works of God might be shown through them. But the second thing I want us to note here is that Matthew's account of this same story in Matthew 15 shows us three things that Mark's account does not. Matthew's account in Matthew 15 shows us, number one, that when this woman comes to Jesus, at first, he simply ignores her. Now, that's, Mark doesn't say that. He goes right in typical Markian fashion. He just gets right into it. Says, okay, well, here's what Jesus said. But in Matthew's account, it says, you know, it shows us that Jesus, you know, is walking down the road with his disciples, and here is this woman behind them, and she's crying out, you know, Lord, have mercy on me. And Jesus just keeps walking. Just doesn't say anything, not a word. Just completely ignores her. And again, that adds, I think, to the kind of the shock of this story and how rude it almost seems. But to add even on top of that, Matthew also notes that what is the disciples' reaction? The disciples are saying to Jesus, send her away. We don't want her here. She's crying out after us. She's making the scene. Send her away. They don't have any compassion on this woman whatsoever. They do not care. All they care is that, you know, she is bothering them. And it all seems very odd. Why would Jesus just completely ignore this woman? It just begs the question, why? And thirdly, Mark's account shows us that Jesus actually has one response before the response in Mark. Jesus' first response to her is, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Now, why would he say that? It actually parallels what he says in Matthew 10, verses 5 and 6, when Jesus sends the apostles out on this first limited commission, and he tells them to go out, but he tells them only to go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. This is who they needed to attend to first. And I think that's an important connection to make here in regards to why Jesus does what he does and why he says what he says. And the first thing he says to her is, let the children be fed first. So even when he finally does respond to her, it seems at first glance that he is not going to heal her daughter, that he is not going to give her what she wants. This non-committal response, I think, is very surprising, especially given the woman's persistence. And at first read, it may even seem offensive. You know, he says, why? Because it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. I mean, is Jesus calling this woman a dog? What in the world? But what he is really saying is that the children of Israel, God's chosen people, must be tended to first. In the same way that when you have a meal in your house, you don't give your children's food to the dogs. That's not what you do. Your children are special. They deserve your attention. They need your attention and your care. You love them. You have a special relationship with them. And they just, frankly, they take priority over the dogs. Now, some people, I've kind of questioned that, how much they love their dogs. But, you know, the children take priority over the dogs. The dogs get the leftovers. And so we need to understand that Israel, as God's chosen people, was privileged. And the gospel would be presented to them first. Jesus' ministry would go to them first. It was focused on them. God, of course, knew that most would reject it, and then it would go to the Gentiles, and of whom many would receive the word gladly. But the mission was mostly left to the apostles after Jesus' death, namely Paul, as we noted. And this is evidenced clearly throughout the story of the book of Acts. But I think what we need to understand here is that one is fed first. That implies the other is fed second, and that they are both fed the same thing. Now, Jesus also makes three comparisons here that I think help us understand this. He says, it's not right, let the children be fed first. It's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Well, the first thing he says is the children. Okay, well, who are the children here? The children are the Jewish people. They had the special relationship. They were the ones through whom the Messiah came. They were going to be, as a privileged society, receive this message first. Well, what, or receive the bread first. And what was the bread? The bread was his message. This message had to go out to the Jews so that they would believe in him. And Jesus says in John 6, 35 and 48 that he is the bread of life. And so he makes that connection there. He is life-giving. He is life-sustaining. Jesus' message, Jesus himself, as the Word, is the bread. And then thirdly, he talks about the dogs. Well, okay, well, the dogs, yes. And as odd as it may seem, the dogs here in the story are the Gentiles. Now, is Jesus using it in a derogatory way? No, he's not even using it. It's a different word here. The Pharisees literally would refer to the Gentiles as dogs, but they would use a word that was, you know, like rabid, you know, wild dogs, versus the word Jesus used here is actually more what they would have used for like a pet. And so actually it was not, he's not saying it in a derogatory way. What he's doing is highlighting the difference. He's not saying they're unimportant. He does, I think, highlight unworthiness, as we are all unworthy. But really the comparison here is not between Gentiles and dogs. The comparison here to be focused on is the difference between Jews and Gentiles. And only specifically as to who would receive this life-giving message, this life-giving bread of the gospel first. And so I think we need to not be too broad with the application here. He's simply highlighting the difference in the order of who would receive the message first, Jews or Gentiles. And we also need to see here that when Jesus says, let the children be fed first, that word first holds out hope for the Gentile. It implies that the dogs in the story, the Gentiles, would also be fed in due time in their proper order. Second, that means there is hope for the Gentile. That Jesus is trying to do things in their proper time, much like when his mother pleads with him to do something about the wine at the wedding in John chapter 2 in Cana, and he says to her, what does this have to do with me? My time has not yet come. He's thinking, you know, kind of getting a little ahead of schedule here, in other words. It's coming. And Jesus is foreshadowing that. But it's just not yet. The other thing Jesus is really doing here, much like he did with many others for whom he healed or cast out demons, and even at times with his own disciples, I believe what he's doing here is he is testing her faith. He wants to see how persistent she is. He wants to see how she's going to react to this kind of off-putting response. How desperate is she? What is her level of understanding? And most importantly, what is her level of faith? Not only for his benefit, but for hers as well. Does she really believe in him and his power? What is her response? How does she prove it? How does she prove her faith? As Abraham shows us, faith is proven by our actions. And she says to him, yes, Lord. In other words, I get it. Yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Wow. What a humble, contrite, understanding response. If somebody walked up to you and called you a dog, what would your response be? What are you talking about? That's so rude. This woman just says, yeah, that's me. I don't deserve it. I think this is surprising in and of itself. It seems that she understands what he is saying. And her response is both humble and persistent. It acknowledges Jesus as Lord, which is something that we all probably need to do a better job of. And she understands and humbly accepts that God called Israel first for a particular purpose, and yet she continues. She is persistent, much like the persistent widow of Luke chapter 18. Likewise, I think this tells us that we need to be persistent in prayer, even when there is no initial response, or at least no initial positive response. And I think that's what's so difficult, because we have a hard time often, I think, in seeing those initial responses, those initial changes that we want to see, and it makes us want to just give up. And the story here is showing us, just because you don't get the right response in your mind the first time, that you just give up and walk away. This woman, she could have very easily said, well, he's just ignoring me, and she could have just stopped in her tracks and stopped following him and stopped crying out, and yet she doesn't do that. She probably heard the disciples in front of her saying, "Lord, send her away," and she paid no attention. She kept walking. She kept crying out. So we need to be persistent in prayer. Our Heavenly Father knows how to give good gifts to His children. And she says, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs." She humbly admits and accepts her position as the dog in the story, as someone lesser, as someone unworthy, as someone unpleasant, as someone sinful, as someone worthless. But it is that understanding and that humility that brings her, and I think brings all of us, brings anyone, to the point of bowing their knees to the Father and thus making them worthy in that act of receiving God's forgiveness and mercy and grace and blessing. Is it offensive?
Should it be? Harsh?
Yeah.
Sometimes we need harsh. Sometimes we need to be called out.
When you think about it, in God's eyes, what is the sinner? The sinner is someone who is unholy and who is deserving of punishment. Dogs. We all need to acknowledge our position before God before we receive His forgiveness. We are unworthy of what He does for us, and yet He does it anyway. Thirdly, she says, they eat the children's crumbs. Even the dogs get something. Maybe they don't get it first, but they do get something. They get some of the blessings. Even if it's just a little, they are still provided for. And she understands that that's all she needs. All she needs is a little. She understands that for Jesus, this is nothing. Healing her daughter, casting this demon out, for Jesus, is a very small thing. I think she gets that. She understands His power, and she's asking, "Lord, for a crumb." She's not asking for much. She's not asking Him to do something difficult. And she has full faith that He is able to do it. And it is that faith and that humility that allow her request to be granted. It is this statement of persistent faith that moved Jesus to cast the demon out. When you come back after what seems like an initial denial, it shows belief in the one that you are petitioning, that person has the power to grant the request. It shows that you are not too proud to place your life in their hands. And this is what we sorely need to take away from this story, is that we need to come down bowing before the Lord, begging Him to be merciful unto us sinners. We need to place our lives in His hands. We need to have humility before Him. And we need to be persistent in our prayer and our petitions. When we go to God with something, we need to recognize that we are unworthy, that we are nothing more than unworthy dogs. Maybe, I understand that it sounds harsh. I don't like saying it. But there is a level on which it is true. We don't deserve even the crumbs. Yet what does God do? He lifts us up from that position as the dog under the table, begging for scraps, and what does He do? He makes us children. He makes us heirs. He adopts us. He places us up in a position of honor at the table. And He provides us with the richest blessings, everything to enjoy spiritually and physically. He gives us to us what we do not deserve. And when we go to Him with our requests and they're not answered, maybe He's testing our faith. Maybe He wants us to be more persistent. Maybe He wants us to trust that He has the authority and power to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think. And that our lives lie completely in His hands. Maybe He just wants us to trust. And so this morning, as we look at this story in Mark chapter 7, we all need to follow the example of this woman of great faith who acknowledged her position, who is persistent in her request, who came to Jesus who fell down at his feet worshiping him, acknowledging her position as a sinner, begging for mercy, and trusting in the outcome.